I'm Christopher Lydon with the poet of history and hurricanes, Teresa Cader, in our poetry series, Whose Words These Are, on Open Source. We call our show An American Conversation with Global Attitude, which sounds something like Teresa Cader's poetry. She grew up in Trenton, New Jersey, a child of Europe, she felt, Polish immigrant father, Irish-American mother. It was Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass, she says, that made her an American and a poet. She lives now around the corner from the first skirmish in the American Revolution, and she teaches young poets at Lesley University outside Boston. Teresa Cader, start with where you come from and how you became a poet. There probably was a poem or a poet that summoned you.
I'm from Trenton, New Jersey, and my first real encounter with poetry was discovering in high school Leaves of Grass on my father's bookshelf and reading it one night and recognizing myself. And there's some history to that in that my father was an immigrant from Poland and came here after the First World War. And my grandfather had escaped Poland because he refused to fight for the Austrians. And then later, part of my family went back and were on the first boat coming out when Hitler was going in. But I grew up with European art as my and literature as my background. So our shelves, even though my father only had an eighth grade education in America, our shelves were lined with Tolstoy and Conrad and Chinese poets and European art. And we only went, this is very unusual for someone from this class background, we only went to foreign movies. I was going to Bergman in the third grade, and it frankly gave me nightmares. And watching Fellini and Kurosawa, and we never went to an American movie. So my idea of art was very distanced from my own experience. And what lodged in me was opening Walt Whitman and finding Song of Myself and finding a voice that gave me permission to be beyond class, in a sense, you know, to find a voice that was distinctive and my own and idiosyncratic. And I wrote a poem and woke my parents up in the middle of the night and read it to them. But that was my first way around that heavy sort of burdensome history of European consciousness. And my second experience with poetry was that I took 4 years of Latin, and in my senior year, we translated the Aeneid. And what I learned from that experience was less the story of the Aeneid than what every word meant and how important it was that every word be right and that there were multiple interpretations that one could bring to a text, to a word, to a sentence. And then in graduate school, I translated Beowulf from the Old English. So in each of those instances, I was taking a text and learning what each word meant.
Out of all that, Teresa Cader, give us one poem that you'd hang up as kind of a touchstone from the past, somebody else's, and then we'll get to yours.
Now, I am going to pick a poem by Czesław Miłosz.
Yes.
Okay, I'm not picking an American at this point, but and it's entitled Dedication. Don't know if you know that poem. It's haunting. And I wanted to make a comparison. This I would put Miłosz in the sort of high school of poetry and certainly his stance on a number of issues. And I wanted to compare him with Szymborska, a totally different poet. And in Dedication, I so admire a kind of almost death grip that he has on the poem, a directness, an unflinching vision, and a fearlessness. Dedication by Czesław Miłosz. You whom I could not save, listen to me. Try to understand this simple speech, as I would be ashamed of another. I swear, there is in me no wizardry of words. I speak to you with silence, like a cloud or a tree. What strengthened me for you was lethal. You mixed up farewell to an epoch with the beginning of a new one. Inspiration of hatred with lyrical beauty. Blind force with accomplished shape. Here is the valley of shallow Polish rivers, and an immense bridge going into white fog. Here is a broken city, and the wind throws the screams of gulls on your grave when I am talking with you. What is poetry which does not save nations or people? A connivance with official lies. A song of drunkards whose throats will be cut in a moment. Readings for sophomore girls. That I wanted good poetry without knowing it. That I discovered late its salutary aim. In this, and only this, I find salvation. They used to pour millet on graves or poppy seeds to feed the dead who would come disguised as birds. I put this book here for you, who once lived, so that you should visit us no more. It's a shocking ending.
It is.
And that's what I mean about his fearlessness. There is a time to end those poetic, you know, gestures, those mixing up, you know, art and war.
Would you say you've taken that to heart in your own work? I mean, do you teach that as a sort of sermon to poets?
Well, I do teach. I teach in the MFA program at Lesley University, low residency MFA program, and I do teach a seminar on sort of writing about catastrophe. And so this is one of the poems, you know, that I teach. And I find, you know, it's been hard for American poets because we have not suffered. I would not say we, because, of course, populations of us have, including African Americans. But we have not suffered on our own soil in the same way. And
well,
yet the
Whitman would say, Whitman and others would say the Civil War qualified.
Well, I think the Civil War qualified, as well as he has astonishing passages in Leaves of Grass about watching a slave auction. And so I would say that yes, but I'm speaking about I've taught so many poets who have historical stories that they want to tell, familial stories, but that they're a couple steps removed from. And there can be a kind of a gauze that comes over a poet in an attempt to make an empathic identification with a situation. And this is one poem which I think helps me to talk to poets about how to get at deeper truths and how to be really courageous with that work and fearless and to keep their own egos out of it. You know, that this is not... That in the poetry of witness, it is not an attempt to glorify the self. That, you know, there's a stance one must take that is to step back from, you know, this is my suffering, unless, of course, it is, to be able to see that suffering more clearly.
Hmm. Yes. What was the Szymborska?
Szymborska is, of course, enormously different. And, in fact, in their two Nobel Prize-winning speeches were quite different. And Miłosz was, of course, quite eloquent and grand, and she stood up and said something like, well, the hardest part of a speech is the first sentence. Well, I got over that. essentially. I may not be quoting accurately. But I am so also, and I talk a lot about scale in poems that deal with horror and catastrophe. And I love that this is the beginning and the end. And listen to how this poem begins. After every war, someone has to clean up. Why didn't we think? It's so powerful. Things won't straighten themselves up, after all. You can hear the tone. Someone has to push the rubble to the sides of the road so the corpse-laden wagons can pass. Someone has to get mired in scum and ashes, sofa springs, splintered glass, and bloody rags. Someone must drag in a girder to prop up a wall. Someone must glaze a window, rehang a door. Photogenic, it's not, and takes years. All the cameras have left for another war. It's a wonderful line. Again, we'll need bridges and new railway stations. Sleeves will go ragged from rolling them up. Someone, broom in hand, still recalls how it was. Someone listens and nods with an unsevered head. Yet others, milling about, already find it dull. From behind the bush, sometimes someone still unearths rust-eaten arguments and carries them to the garbage pile. Those who knew what was going on here must give way to those who knew little, and less than little, and finally as little as nothing. In the grass which is overgrown causes and effects, someone must be stretched out, blade of grass in his mouth, gazing at the clouds.
What's to add?
I am affected every time I read that poem. I am reminded that history is about individuals. It is really about the person who has to push the sofa springs off the street after the street has been bombed. I guess in that sense, I have an Emersonian view of history, that there aren't these history robots running around, you know, unleashing their forces, that history is very much the actions of individuals and is very much, you know, the plight of the peasant as well as the plight of the emperor. And so in this poem, if I use it as a teaching device too, I talk about scale. I talk about how important it is to get at some of the most difficult and painful things by using something small, by taking a small detail that can say so much, that it aptly chosen can say what a grandiose poem, a poem that attempts to be grandiose, can't accomplish. So,
I hear you talk. I hear Zimborska talking about the cameras going to the next war, and I think out of Iraq into Afghanistan.
That is one of the most powerful lines. All the cameras have left for another war, and it seems that nothing has changed. That if we read our paper today, it's almost nothing but war. In every part of the world, not every part of the world. That's an exaggeration, but in so many parts of the world, and of course, we are leaving Iraq for Afghanistan, it seems, and that she has, it isn't a jaundiced sense. She has a very astute sense of human history, which I appreciate and learn from.
Teresa Cater, we're taking this moment to kind of take stock of We're taking this moment to listen to both the stuff of poetry in our world and the community of poetry. Place yourself in the great chain of poetic being here. Where are we?
Well, someone once asked me, well, are you in the William Carlos Williams camp or the Wallace Stevens camp? And I wanted to say I'm in both and neither. But if I had to place myself in a tradition, it would be closer to William Carlos Williams. But I'm very eclectic in my tastes. And, you know, I think the slam poet Reggie Gibson is astonishing. And one of my, one of the poets who speaks to me the most is George Herbert. Mm. I learned a lot from John Donne. I return to Elizabeth Bishop often. I have a different history and a different historical perspective, I would say, from Lowell, but Lowell has certainly been really important to me. I love the language of Yeats, the lyricism, the music. I'm quite metaphysical, but I've been particularly found my roots in the language of poems and what poems can do on the page. I would say that in my last book, that's become, you know, really important to me.
Let's hear from the history of hurricanes.
Okay. Well, I could start with one that is called Bone Shaker. And I don't know if you know what a bone shaker is.
I suppose there are many bone shakers.
I turn the tables on the interviewer. But It was the first name for the bicycle. It was a bone shaker, and I frankly don't think they should have changed the name. So bone shaker. Not to need a horse or have to wait for a carriage, to slip away, jut away, pedal off on a whim or in a fury, without permission or charge, with nothing but wind and pebbles, cumulus dust or a heckle of driven rain, in knickers or barn bibs, and one day, bloomers. Out of the sweltering clan, fetid farmhouse, loose on a lane of poplars, upright as gendarme, churning rutted roads speckled with poppies, grazed by pheasant or hare, into night, if need be, or dawn's lavender light before anyone checks the beds. Out of the argument or the sermon, to the spokes and wheels, the steering bar and column, the wooden seat searing the tailbone, the spinal S a serpentine lash in a field of raspberries unglimpsed from trains. Something idiosyncratic, shaped by will and fueled by muscle. A bone shaker, taking its rider away, there or anywhere.
Aha! Uh-huh. I get it. Yeah. What was I thinking? Who knows?
I don't know. But I wanted to capture the movement as well as the mobility, the social mobility, but certainly the movement of the bike.
Mm. More.
It's interesting because that, you know, one of the ways that this book took shape, and I'll come back to history of hurricanes and how that was sort of central, became central to the book, was I wrote the word anywhere, and then I started thinking about the word anywhere. And as if you notice in the book, there are poems called Anywhere, Nowhere, Elsewhere, Somewhere, Dwell, Dwell Nowhere. And I didn't set out to write those poems so much as those things intrigued me. Those words intrigued me and what they conjured for me.
Would you read the Dwell poem for me? Which
Dwell. It begins with the 23rd Psalm. And I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. But is there clutter in the house of the Lord? Stacks of unanswered prayers on the desk, for instance, or white terry cloth robes dangling from doorknobs, their belt tips soiled black, or gobs of angel hair gumming up the pipes as sticky CDs skip through the morning cantatas, or an infidel army of dust mites pillaging cushions on the velvet throne. I would want to know these things before I agreed to move. Cleanliness ranks with godliness, I've been told, and clutter's a curse on one's house. One can't see into the heart of a clutterer. Who knows what lurks in the leaky valves or flooded chambers, tattered flaps and pockmarked walls? In a mess like that, love can get trashed. I'd better put my own house in order. Why not start with dwell and dust the hell out of it?
Thank you.
Now, you don't want to be invited to my house.
I'm warned. Would you give us the history of hurricanes?
I will. So the poem moves between colonial Lexington, Kyoto, contemporary Lexington. My kids had to study a book on hurricanes, which they hated. So they didn't see any hurricanes. They'd never seen one. It didn't mean anything to them. And a quote, you'll hear the quote that I found in the OED. So history, and I think the history of hurricanes really is about the forces we can't control. And so much of this book is about the forces that we can't control. History of hurricanes. Because we cannot know, we plant crops, make love in the light of our not knowing. A Minuteman prods cows from the green with his musket, his waxed paper windows snapping in the wind. Stiletto stalks in the herb garden upright, now blown sideways, now weighted down in genuflection, not toward. And a frail man holding an Imari teacup paces at daybreak in his courtyard in Kyoto. A cherry tree petaling the stones pink and slippery in the weeks he lay feverish, waiting for word from the doctor, checking for signs. Now, in the season of earthenware sturdiness and dependency, it must begin, the season of his recovery. No whirling dervish on the radar, no radar, no brackets, no voices warning, no voice, fugue of trees, lightning. Because we cannot know, we imagine. What will happen to me without you? I know some things I remember. The Delaware River, two stories high inside the brick houses, cars floating past Trenton like a regiment on display, brown water climbing our basement stairs two at a time. Like months of remission, the eye shifts. The waxed paper windows burst behind the flapping shutters. And how could he save his child after that calm? A man who'd never seen a roof sheared off. Across town, the ninth graders in their cutoffs. Science sucks, they grouse. Stupid history of hurricanes. No one can remember one. Velocity, storm surge, abstractions, the earth churns as Isabel rips through Buzzard's Bay. A hurricane, as one meaning has it, a large crowded assembly of fashionable people at a private house. The river cannot remember its flooding. I worry you will forget to check the watermarks in time. An echo of feet on stone is all the neighbors knew of their neighbor, a lover of cherry trees, and of his wife who prayed for him at the shrine, her hair swept up in his favorite onyx comb.
No one can remember a hurricane, and yet we'll never forget Katrina. I'm wondering, Teresa, what is it of this sort of post-Katrina world, in the broadest sense, that you're addressing in your poetry? I mean, 2009 in general.
I think, I have many thoughts about this. I, for one, applaud the fact that there's so much poetry. I know there are people who think it's a dilution, maybe, and I don't see it that way. I think to have a country where people are reading poetry and writing poetry means that we have people whose impulses are towards something larger than the self, hopefully, who can have a conversation that goes across cultures and across centuries. And I think the individual voice is critical. And we must do everything to preserve and nurture it. And I actually believe passionately that children who are autistic need to have those outlets. For instance, I think the self suffers if one cannot find a way to express oneself creatively. So when I look at what the burgeoning sort of poetry world, I don't want to put the lens on it that says, well, this isn't high art, or this is internet art, or this is, you know, too many people getting MFAs, too many people in writing programs. I in the Tang Dynasty, you got a job in government. If you could, part of the civil service exam was that you had to write a poem. Now, can you imagine what a different country we would have if our politicians and our civil servants and our elected officials had to write a poem? But I do believe in the primacy of the individual voice, and I don't think it's obviated by the need, the importance of doing public service. I think that's one of the things that the Favorite Poem Project showed us, was that people all over the country are responding, you know, to poetry. If we look at even the Lowell Poetry Festival that's coming up, the having poets go into high schools, I think is critical. I've done a lot of work in the schools, and I've worked a lot with little kids. Mm.
What do you teach in public schools, and what do you learn about this world today?
Students are hungry for a kind of emotional truth in schools that they're not getting. They're hungry to integrate their feelings with their learning. They're hungry to have somebody speak the truth about life. Mm.
Teresa, indulge us in the Proust questionnaire, or the Proust in the Grolier Bookshop questionnaire. Who's your ideal artist in another medium, contemporary or historical?
Well, I really like sculpture, and I like a lot of sculptors, and I get a visceral reaction to sculpture. You know, everything from going back to the Greeks and Romans and you know, the Italians, and from Donatello and Brancusi, and Giacometti is one of my favorites. I also like the whimsy of Calder and, you know, and people like Henry Moore. But there are two. One artist I particularly like is Magdalena Abakanowicz. And I like sculptors who also work in other media, and she works in fiber. And I don't know if you've seen her work, but she's done installations, some of them are based on the Holocaust, of these enormous woven headless figures. And you find like a whole group of them, maybe 20, that are in a crouched and seating position, headless, and they're woven. And I find her work astonishing. Mm.
What do you think was the keynote of your personality as a poet?
I like to inhabit mystery and the unknown. I like to push to beyond what's comfortable to a place where I don't know where I am. And to be able to bring my intellect and my emotions together so that it's an emotionally fueled intellect or you know, and intellectually fueled emotions. I love that combination because I think ideas excite me as well. So I like to have both parts of that involved. It's what turns me on.
What's the talent that you most love that you don't have yet?
I am trying to close the gap between myself, my voice, and the page.
This just suggests to me your poem, Counterpoint. Would you read it?
Yes. Counterpoint 1. I wish I could jazz forth a trumpet from my pocket, a sax from my belly, a clarinet from my larynx. My music lessons short-circuited in the third grade. Beware the child who speaks without words, who sidles up to a piano as if it were human and plays for days in a shroud of harmonic occlusion, neither naive nor aware her inner life's a shrine the jealous will invade. too. Ah, she's in there walloping Mozart again, mastering the art of practice. At least Beethoven couldn't have heard himself parodied. Gifted fingers and ear unite to outsmart the score, the money, the time, the nagging and bickering. Then I hear it, the long Chopin cadenza, like the flourish and pitch of a cardinal darting from our driveway at dusk. 3. Word-free is my anchorless boat, spinning lopsided down a river studded with dragonflies. In a staccato rush to the sea, the river erases what I thought was thought. I guess I am jealous of musicians.
Aren't we all?
And wish that I had had more musical training and that I could do it. You know, that to be able to do that without words is also a liberation.
What's the great quality you love in a poem?
Well, I need to be moved emotionally. Not everyone does. And not a poem that necessarily sets out to grab my emotions. But I have a somewhat metaphysical sensibility so that I like, you know, I value that marriage between the intellect and emotions. It's one of the reasons that I like the metaphysical poets. It's one of the reasons that John Donne taught me so much. It's one of the things I like, as I said, about, I'm only going to mention one contemporary poet, about Robert Pinsky.
Teresa Cato, what's your motto?
Push beyond what you know, and that process is what one should be going for, not product. That the process is where the discoveries happen.
We love this process of listening to you.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you,
Teresa. You do a wonderful job of asking hard questions.
Thank you.
Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with Teresa Cator. Our Brown University interns Hannah Olson and Ben Mandelkern studied up with us and helped find a way through the words. Thanks to the Grolier Poetry Bookshop for making a sort of studio between their shelves. Also to the Massachusetts Poetry Festival for helping us round up the poets. Thanks to listeners who leave a comment or a poem at our website, radioopensource.org. And thanks to all for listening. I'm Christopher Lydon.